up, it actually represents a very huge proportion of the overall teaching force here at SFU.
Correct.
Pretty much everybody other than professors.
Yeah, a lot of our workers do, or like 50% of the face time teaching at the university. So, yes.
And what are the big issues that are on the table here that the TSSE is trying to get addressed?
So there are like three key issues for us in this round of bargaining. First one is addressing the cost of living in this real expensive city to live in. As you may know, housing prices are going up every day, like every other month at astronomical rates. And our members are struggling, a lot of them struggling to like keep up with the increasing cost of living. And one of the key demands in this round is that there are wage increases that are delivered to them so that they can keep up with this cost of living, especially the graduate workers at this institution. Second demand is trying to modernize the classrooms. So SFU has been doing wage theft for decades now. A lot of our workers do not get paid for the work they have been doing at this institution. They have been overworked. Wages have been stolen from them for the work they have already been doing over the years. So one solution to this problem is to like modernize the compensation model for the teaching. And one way to do it is to tie it to class sizes, which right. SFU has been declining to do so far. Even though we have provided them data, we have provided them rationale, we have provided them a model which would actually work. But SFU is yet to provide a meaningful counter proposal to this.
Right. And if I understand correctly, the current model is basically kind of like a flat fee that doesn't take into account the varying workloads of different disciplines, different classroom sizes and all that.
So, I mean, it is slightly complicated,
sorry.
I would say. I mean, the model that SFU has, I mean, we have tried to build at SFU over the years is tying the compensation model to things that are tangible. For example, number of hours in the lecture mm-hmm. or number of hours in the labs, tutorials. Now, what has happened over the years is some of these have been eroded by things called equivalencies. Which are adjustments to these calculation formulas. And with the arrival of like hybrid classrooms now, there is an option to pack the classrooms with more students than what would physically be possible in a physical classroom.
Right.
So that presents a new challenge for us, and we do want to get addressed it like early in the, like right now when these hybrid classrooms or like remote classrooms are just starting to spring up. So it would be better to address it now than in future, but mm-hmm. it would be more difficult. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, yeah. And then I interrupted you. You were going to go on to your third demand.
Yeah, the third demand is providing long-term security for a lot of the instructors, special instructors, ELCIDM instructors who have been here for decades, a lot of them mm-hmm. Starting in the 90s, some of them, and trying to provide them a pension and a pathway to like long-term job security in terms of for ELCIDM instructors, they're looking for a well-defined work year, and for sessional instructor, like pathway to continuing faculty positions,
right.
which they should have gotten a long time ago, considering that they have been teaching for like almost a couple of decades now. So.
Right. All right. So you were bargaining yesterday.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Not too well. There weren't any meaningful proposals from the employer, we had already notified them like well in advance that hey, this, if we don't have a deal by this day,
mm-hmm.
and we will be going on indefinite work stoppage for
right.
all teaching work at the institution, and they didn't even make an attempt to get to a deal. So they apparently want us to escalate the job action. I don't understand the rationale behind that,
mm-hmm.
but there wasn't any meaningful counter on any of our key proposals, despite having explained and provided data on all of our proposals. We still haven't heard anything meaningful from the employer, and it looks like we'll be heading to escalate a job action starting Thursday.
Excellent. And what does that escalate a job action going to look like? Because up until now you've done rotating pickets, you've done some sort of work to rule stuff, limiting perhaps marking, was it? But stuff that that for the most part wasn't having a huge impact on students, or at least a limited impact.
Yeah.
So what comes next?
And I mean, we have been mindful. We are workers, and we care about like the student population more than most of, like more than the employer ever would and ever has or ever would. So what it would look like starting Thursday is we're going to have indefinite work stoppages. So all teaching work done by TCU members will be struck starting September 28 on all campuses, all locations, including online classes. This means there will be no tutorials, no labs, no lectures, no office hours, no emails to students or course supervisors, no marking. And this will continue till we get a deal. And I mean, the picket lines right now, what we're planning is to be rotating between campuses.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one will be in Surrey, but like work will be stopped at all locations, right, including online.
So this is going to be quite a big deal.
Correct. And we never wanted to escalate it this far.
Right.
As I said, we are really mindful of the students and the SFE community. And we will be trying to mitigate, because our fight is against the employer. It's not against the students.
Right. It's been 5 minutes since you issued, 5 months since you issued strike notice to SFU. Now you're moving to this next step after yesterday's bargaining. How much has there been in that 5 months? You know, has there been much movement from the university at all?
So after the job actions, so SFU started with a lot of concessions on the table for us. There were significant concessions to seniority rights for sessionals, guaranteed work for graduate students, there's still a threat on the table for the scholarship component of pay for TAs, which is sort of like a wage cut inherently. A lot of our job actions, like our three pickets we did in summer, that sort of helped address some of these concessions. So those have gone off the table. So I would say there is some effect for our job actions, but we're still nowhere near a deal the way things stand.
Right.
And as I said, we don't like going on strike as much as the community does. Yeah. It's just we don't have a choice at this point. We are fighting for our lives. We are fighting for our livelihood. We are trying to survive.
All right. So that's pretty big news. So on Thursday, when students show up to campus, what can they expect?
So if you're coming to Surrey campus on Thursday, you can expect picket lines on all the buildings. If you see a picket line, do not cross it. We encourage all our undergraduate students and workers to respect our picket lines and join us on our picket lines. That is your biggest way of supporting us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Okay. Now, this is something that is perhaps more the university's responsibility, but I'm sure it's something that students are going to be thinking about. What accommodation or what allowances are made for students when they're respecting a picket line?
So, Senate has set out guidelines right now for respecting a picket line. So instructors have the discretion to provide them with accommodations for missed coursework. So that has been like there since it was renewed in the last Senate meeting.
Right.
So there are some weak protections there, but it's not strong enough. So this is something that probably the student population might want to like organize on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And something that going into the future, trying to have like stronger rights for respecting a picket line.
Yeah.
But I think like the key thing that students can do is to encourage their faculty members to cancel these classes, mm-hmm, that are being held. during a picket line,
right,
asking them not to cross, because SFEFA is also a union, and there's strong support from the faculty members as well going into this particular strike.
Mm-hmm. And for students, obviously this is a fairly new situation. If you're an undergrad, I think I would urge you to contact the Undergrad Student Society, San Francisco Student Society. They are a student union, not a labor union, but they are your advocacy group here on campus to find out more about how this might affect you. I think the university will also be posting stuff on their website about what's happening. Do you have your finger up? So I think you got something to say. So
yeah, I was also going to say there's going to be a student support tent right by the picket lines headquarters. It's going to be staffed by the SFSS advocate and the GSS advocate. So that is something you can expect at the picket line as well.
Okay.
If you're looking for support.
I do want to say, if you're listening out there and you see that staff, and I've talked to both Trish, the SFSS advocate, and Harjap, the GSS advocate. They are super informed, really knowledgeable, and I think they will be able to answer your questions. Let you know what you need to do to both support the grad students who are striking for the TSSU and protect yourself. So what do you think? I guess this is the big step. Do you have an idea of how you expect the university to respond?
I mean, the university works because we do. Mm-hmm. And when we withdraw our labor, it would be interesting to see how the core activities, the key core mission of the university, which is one of them is teaching, is going to be delivered. So I do think we'll get to a deal with the job action. We have done this before, in 2015. We're doing this again, and we will get there. We will win our contract.
All right. Well, that's big developments on the TSSU front. Thank you so much for coming to tell us about where things are at, Amal.
Thank you.
I know it's been a long struggle for you guys going back well before the issuing of the strike notice. It's been going, quite a long time, and hopefully there's going to be a resolution for you guys soon.
Thank you.
Amal Vincent is the chief steward of the Teaching Support Staff Union here at SFU. They are, I guess we can say it, you're on strike.
We have been on strike for a few months now.
Yep. Looking for some changes and a better deal with the university. Thanks for joining me today, Amal.
Thanks, Magnus.
And hopefully we can have you back next week or the week after. I think probably things will start moving.
That sounds good. I'll be back for an update.
Great. Thanks so much for joining me today, Amal. Amal Vincent, Chief Steward of the TSSU. We're going to go on with some music here. Next up is Zoe Wees and a track called Control. That interview was recorded last Tuesday, September 26th. Strike action by the TSSU will be continuing. They'll be picketing the Burnaby campus this morning, and we can expect further announcements about further job action this week.
Fighting my anxiety constantly, I try to control it. Even when I know it's been forever, I can still feel the spin. Hurts when I remember and I never want to feel it again. Don't know if you get it, cause I can't express so thankful I am that you were always with me.
Welcome back. My name is Caroline, and you just listened to Zoe Weiss, and her song is called Control. Now I'm joined by Greg. Welcome, Greg.
Hi.
He's going to read about his review he did on a book.
Yes, the book is Boom Chicago, the 30 Most Important Years in Dutch History.
Sorry, I just forgot to turn your mic on. I'm sorry. Want to start again?
The book is Boom Chicago, the 30 Most Important Years in Dutch History. And the book is about the improv comedy group Boom Chicago. They were started by two men in back in 1993. The goal of these two men were... They were trying to make it in the improv space in the Midwest. For those who don't know, improv is a big thing in the Midwest, Chicago type area. But they were having trouble breaking in. So they decided to take a huge risk and go and move to Amsterdam to start this improv troupe. And this specific troupe, I'd actually known about them for a while because I'm a big fan of sketch comedy, and I knew that a lot of people who came through the old Mad TV show in the late 90s, they were from this group. So I was always interested in them, and reading up on the book, it's a really interesting story. It's because as I read the book, like, I was interested in finding out, okay, how did this group go from being a, you know, sketch comedy group in Amsterdam to being the starting point for many people like Ike Barinholtz, Jordan mm-hmm. Peele, Seth Meyers. And as I was reading it, they would talk about, the book talks about how, you know, the people who would come through as the cast would get ingratiated in the Dutch culture and the ideas of that. But as the book went on, I started like I noticed, like, there at one point, I think it's chapter 4, they talk about going to this amusement park and just riding this amusement park, because the book goes year by year.
Okay.
Like for the 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I was reading this, I'm just like, I don't understand why they're telling this doesn't have anything to do with, you know, how Seth Meyers became, you know, so, you know, knowledgeable that he ended up becoming a writer and eventually cast member, eventually host of his own late night show. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought it was going to be more of those stories, but then I'm hearing this story about an amusement park. And as I read the book, as the book kept going, I started realizing what the book was really about. The book is not, like, the book is about, you know, these sketch comedy people, you know, getting their training and becoming big stars in America. Mm-hmm. But it's also about really an immigrant story. Right. It's these two guys from the Midwest who moved to Amsterdam to bring American-style sketch comedy to Amsterdam. And as they went on and grew and got more attention and got more favor, began to really become, like, citizens of the Netherlands. And, like, towards the end of the book, you see, like, they're doing, like, you know, roast shows, like the White House Correspondents' Dinner, only with the Netherlands Prime Minister, and they're, you know, hobnobbing with big people in the Netherlands political and entertainment sphere. And that's really what the, like, that is almost the second narrative of the book. This, mm-hmm. you know, really wacky, in a way, immigrant story. So that's a, so that was a really interesting part of the book for me. And when reading it, when it comes to the, when it comes to the players like Jordan Peele, like Ike Barinholtz, the, when it comes to the show, they say that what they got out of Boom Chicago more than anything was that it gave them, it always gave them the ability to perform. Like, they were living in Amsterdam, performing nearly every night, always coming up with something new, always changing things on the fly, and that kind of thing gave them more confidence, because now they say, like, they can be given any script, look it over for a couple minutes, and be able to recite it right off. Or if the entire script is changed last minute, they can read that, get it right, and go out there and perform. Mm-hmm. And that is something, and that is something that I think is a valuable thing, because with many things, it's so hard today to get, you know, hours, to get experience, to get, you know, because whether it's, you know, there's not enough time or not enough money, or you're pulled every which way by your responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So this book really shows how valuable getting time and getting experiences, and not just this, but really in anything, because if you can get that experience, you can be the best at what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an interesting aspect of this book, because, like, even Jordan Peele mentioned, like, by the time he got to Mad TV, he wasn't, like, he didn't enjoy that experience, because he went from working, like, 5 days a week, writing stuff every day, to, you know, struggling. Maybe he'll get, like, 1 to 2 sketches on the air, but then it's, like, nothing for the rest of the week. And that's, like, that's understandable. That's a TV show, you know, that's just how it works. But yeah, you can see the difference in, like, you know, the flow, like, you know, you almost have to work hard in the beginning to end up working not as much or less hard as you go mm-hmm. up the chain, which is good and bad in some respects.
Yeah.
So reading the book, I like the book, but I will say I did have some problems with the end of the book.
Okay.
Because the end of the book is, like, the whole book is called The 30 Most Important Years in Dutch History.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the thing is, it gets to, like, the 25th anniversary in 2018, and then just kind of stops there. And I find that odd, because, you know, for a sketch comedy group, for a sketch and improv group that performs live shows in Amsterdam, I would think 2020 and 2021 would be some challenging years and would have a lot of stories there, but there's Absolutely. Just there's just nothing. They don't talk about that period at all. And I found that odd, because as I was reading, I was actually looking forward mm-hmm. to getting to that point, because yeah. I thought, okay, how are they going to manage it? Are they going to increase their online presence? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be doing shows from, like, big bubble, like, big, you know, those big inflatable bubbles yeah. for, like, stage of this? But it didn't happen. And instead, like, the end of the book, it talks about, because, like, Jason Sudeikis was also a part of this, also here for a short time, and he made yeah. Ted Lasso with a bunch of people mm-hmm. on the show. And there's a lot of on Ted Lasso here, but I don't have an Amazon TV Plus, an Apple TV Plus account, mm-hmm. so I've never seen the show. So they're talking, like, inside baseball about the show, and it's just like I eventually, like, stopped reading this point, because I'm just like, they're going on and on about a show I've never seen.
Right.
And that would probably be my one critique on the book. The mm-hmm. ending is not as good as I think it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really my lone major complaint. The rest of the book is still very interesting. Like, it's interesting hearing about, like, different Dutch, like historical things, like they talk about a race that happens in a part of the Netherlands only when the ice freezes over to enough degree. They also say it will probably never happen again because of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, look at that. I'm circling it around to the beginning of the show. But, yeah, so they talk about that. They talk about you know, things like the amusement park and the times they mm-hmm. had there, or about how you know, dating in the Netherlands is different than dating in America, and, you know, taxi yeah. system. So I ended up learning a lot more about Dutch culture than I mm-hmm. expected. And, yeah, so that's... I'm just looking at my notes here to see if yeah. there's anything also I would want to bring up. There is one that, like, when I was growing up, I loved sketch comedy, and I thought about, like, doing it, but
mm-hmm.
it's just, you know, things get in the way, you know, times are different, and it was especially different back then, because back then, you could move to a place like the Netherlands and, you know, be able to at least afford a, you know, semi-good apartment to perform. But nowadays, it's just not as easy, and I think that's something that we need to change as a society, because it's so hard now to move anywhere and do an experience like this, because it's so, like, you wouldn't be able to afford, like, it's hard to, like, live on peanuts and then right. afford all the places. And especially as young people, you know, I think we all have that anxiety with money, like we're incurring so much debt at school.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
it makes it, this is another part of the, like, living experience that we have that makes it so difficult. Like, I look at this and read this and think, oh, I would have loved to have done something like that.
Yeah.
Or, like, I'm in my 30s now, but back in my 20s, like, this was something I wanted to do. This could have been something I wanted to do then, but I was so nervous about, mm-hmm. you know, leaving home and incurring so much debt. And that's something that, it's sad that that's the case, because, yeah. like, reading the stories from people in the book saying, like, how moving to another country, like, it grew them not only as performers, but as people. It certainly made me wonder if, you know, they're still accepting people for sketch comedy internships at 32.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of the book. Kayla, do you have anything else you're wondering about?
I'm wondering, who would you recommend this book to? Like,
I definitely recommend it to comedy fans, because... Uh-huh. They are, like, this is a very comedy-centric book.
Yeah.
It's written by the two people by the two people who started the school. It's got a forward by Seth Meyers, a backwards by Jordan Peele. So it's very much a...